First of all, I should say that it's going to be very elementary, and actually, it's going to be more elementary than what I wrote in the abstract. So if you know what a category is and how it applies to physics and especially physical processes, I suppose you won't learn really a lot of new things, so feel free to leave. This is kind of a measurement-based approach to logic, and this comes from this paper. So actually, the original ideas I'm going to mention are all not mine, but from this paper of Bart Jacobs, who is a computer scientist in Nijmegen in the Netherlands. All right. So what I want to do in this talk is kind of two things. First of all, illustrate the usefulness of category theory. Also, I hope you're going to get some idea of what category theory is about. So if you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. I'll give some idea. So, and why I think that this could be relevant for us as people doing fundamental physics is the following, that we all need some kind of guiding principles in coming up with new theories of physics, right? So fundamental physics needs some kind of guiding principles. It may be, for example, experimental input. But given that we don't have really much new experimental input, we need something else. And personally, what I find very appealing is mathematical naturalness. And the mathematical, let's say, beauty of our theory. And I think category theory has a lot to offer in that respect. And moreover, it kind of provides principles. You can use it as not just a measure of mathematical naturalness, but also as a tool, as a concrete tool to translate things from one particular setting into another setting. And this second aspect is what I'm going to talk about, essentially. Or is it of one instance? I'm going to talk about one instance of that second aspect. So, category theory provides some guiding principles for fundamental physics, so to speak. Okay. And I'm going to illustrate this by means of an example. Which is, oh, sorry, I think I just wrecked the microphone. Okay, so in that example is going to be that particular approach, kind of measurement-based approach to logic. All right, now let me start by talking about processes, physical processes, and how those form categories. And that will also explain what a category actually is, as a mathematical object Also, I'm not going to give the precise definition, but it's going to be implicit, and I hope it'll become sort of clear. Okay, so just very generally speaking, what is a physical process? Well, it should be something which takes some input system, X, and produces or turns it into an output system, Y. This is very much like, I don't know, for example, like a computation or like applying a function. So this input X just stands for a particular system, or actually just a type of a system. So for example, so X might be photon. Or also two photons. All these things would, or if, what a point particle. Okay, so these kind of things could be physical systems. But in general, how to think of this is not as a model of the real world, but more something which you have in your favorite theory of physics. So these are the systems in your theory. For example, if you do Hamiltonian mechanics in terms of symplectic geometry, then these X and Y would be the symplectic manifolds. Well, it depends, but primarily I would say it's about your theory. If you want to make this precise, in particular mathematically precise, you should take these to be the systems as you model them in your theory. And that may be a model of the real world.
What about the distinction between being a model of the real world or a model of the world and being a model of
Yeah, I don't really know. Okay, it's not really a model of something in your theory, but this is the structure you have in the theory.
The structure of the dynamical theory, or is it based on an operationalist kind of framework, conceptualization?
It doesn't matter, whatever. So this doesn't necessarily need to be the whole, all you have in your theory. Your theory can have more than just systems and processes. But any physical theory should have those, right? Whether you interpret this operationally or whatever, it doesn't really matter. The free particle is not really a theory, I would say. But so let's take classical mechanics, where a system would be a symplectic manifold. And then the processes between those should be, to be honest, not sure exactly what they would be, but some kind of symplectic maps. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay, Rob.
In the category theory approach, the objects have a very minimal structure, like just say the dimension of the building space, so type of the dimension of the building space. But the way you're talking makes it seem like it's, you know, you want to think, well, maybe not just dimension, but also how does this thing transform under a symmetry group, like if you distinguish a spin half from eigenspin, for example.
I'll get to that. Well, but actually the kind of the main point of doing this, and I'm going to get to this, is that there's no structure at all in these systems or system types. What's relevant are only the processes between them.
When you said it could be a symplectic manifold,
yeah.
Do you mean a particular
topology dimension? Yes. Yeah, I did mean that. But we need that information only for, or in order to decide what are the allowed processes to other systems, right? So when we need the symplectic structure, for example, in X and Y, just in order to be able to talk about the collection of processes between those, and for nothing else. So you can as well forget about that symplectic structure and define these processes. And that's all you need. You can even forget if the number of points or the points of those spaces. So this is very similar actually to what you're saying, that there is no fundamental difference between kinematics and dynamics. You can describe the same category of processes in very different ways. With system types, you can describe them in many different ways. For example, if we just take them to be sets, we can take them sets and functions between them as processes, and I'm going to get to that, which is kind of a very toy or watered down version of physics, right? We just have sets of states and functions between those. But then we can as well describe this in terms of system types being Boolean algebras and Boolean algebra homomorphisms between those. At least the right post some additional conditions, blah, and it's so. Yes. Yes, yes, exactly. So this is still a structure we can talk about, a structure we have, that when X is equal to Y, and we get those anamorphisms. So these would then be particular processes. So what is the structure we have on the collection of processes, or what can we do with processes? Yeah?
Sometimes we like to characterize systems in terms of how they map under certain transformations that aren't physically possible, like say time version symmetry. Do you mean physical processes really to be the ones that I can implement in the lab, or would you allow transformation of the system under time version to be considered a physical process?
You can do either, but you can do both at the same time. So you have to decide for one of the two things, but that's up to you. All right, so there are kind of two parts of structure essentially here. So that when we have one process going from a system type X to a system type Y, and we have another process taking a system of type Y and producing a system of type Z, then these two processes, or we can just put them one after the other, meaning that we can compose them. So this can be composed to a process which then takes a system of type X and just outputs a system of type Z. The second kind of structure that one should have here in order to get a category is that for every system type X, there should be a trivial process, meaning that a process which just does nothing to a system of type X. So this is a process from X to itself, and I'm just going to draw this not by an arrow, but by such an kind of extended equality equation sign. And third, so this is not a structure anymore, but this is a property. Now, these operations should satisfy an associativity law and a unit law. Let me write this down more or less pictorially, that when we have now a process from a type system type W to a system type X, we compose this using that operation with another process from X to Y. So this gets a composed process from W to Y, and then we compose this composed process with a third one to some system type Z, then the total compose process is the same as one from W. If we could first compose these two from X to Y and then to Z, and then the W in front. Okay, and there are the two unit laws. When I start with a system of type X, apply this trivial process which does nothing, and then apply a process which gives Y. This should obviously be the same as, no, okay, this is a bit bad notation because this is, you know, really an equality sign and not the, so let me maybe write this as like this. This should be the same process as just going from X to Y. And similarly, if I apply the trivial process on the Y side, I should also get the same. Okay, so with these two pieces of structure and these equations, the collection of processes forms a category. That's what a category is, as a mathematical object. So in this way, the collection of processes is a category. So let me just give some examples. These are not supposed to describe real physics, but these are just supposed to be simple to understand. So the first example being kind of, and these are, will also be the examples which give rise to this categorical logic or this categorical approach to logic developed by Jacobs. So the first example would be, let's take classical systems. So classical as opposed to quantum, where a system type is just a set. Physically, this should be thought of as a set of states. That a system can have, and a process is just a map between these two. Oops. So this is quite boring, I guess. Second example, the probabilistic systems, or let me call this probabilistic dynamics. So in this category of processes, a system is again just a set of states. But now I define a process to be a probabilistic map between sets. Well, what's a probabilistic map? So by probabilistic map, I just mean that for every element little x of a set of state x on the domain of the process, I'm going to get a probability distribution p of y over the elements little y of the codomain. So this is a conditional probability distribution conditional distribution P of y given x, or let's say a stochastic matrix. So in the case of finite sets, this is just a stochastic matrix. And well, in the case of infinite sets, I would have to be a bit more careful than this anyway and talk about sigma algebras, but okay, these are technical details. All right, so the third example, now we went from classical to probabilistic. Now let's go to quantum. Third example would be quantum dynamics. Or, well, quantum systems, processes between quantum systems. So in this case, the system, well, usually we do quantum mechanics in terms of Hilbert spaces and states on those, right? But I think the more natural approach to quantum mechanics actually uses these algebras. If you don't know what that is, well, it's like, think of it as matrices on some Hilbert space, or just n by n matrices. So a system is a Caesar algebra in this case. And so this contains, this is the algebra of observables of the quantum system. So I'm not going to write x and y for those because, well, that would just be a very unusual notation for a quantum system, for Caesar algebras, and I'm going to write kind of script A and B and so on. And a process between the system of type, a system of type A and a system of type B is a unital completely positive map. So this is just the usual dynamics of open quantum systems, right? So a unital completely positive map. Now comes the important part, going the other way from B to A. So the reason why this should go the other way is that this is the, and if we work on the level of observable algebras, we're essentially in a Heisenberg picture, which means that when we have a process going from a system A to a system B, this we can use to pull back the observables. When we work on the level of the observable algebras, we can pull back an observable on the system B to the system A. And this is actually how we define a process. That a process is the operation of pulling back the observables. Okay, and the fourth and last example. Yeah, I'm not really sure what the right, how to call this, what the right term for this could be, but I've called it irregular dynamics. So this is more in line of the first and second example, so that again, a system is just a set of states. Actually, now I think I know how it should be called. It should be called non-deterministic. So this is a lot like the non-determinism one sees in classical computer science. So in a process from X to Y, I'm going to define to be a function from the set of state X to the power set of Y. So this is the power set, and this means that so for every element, for every state on X, I'm actually going to get a whole set of possible output states, a whole set of states which are allowed by that process. So in this sense, that represents a non-deterministic process. It can have zero output states. In this case, the process would sort of be impossible, or there would be no dynamics allowed from here. In the computer science term, we would have a kind of like a termination symbol of a Turing machine. Neither of the two. It's non it's you, here we don't have any probabilities, but still we have no. There are no probabilities at all. We cannot talk about probabilities here. Yes, exactly. Yeah. The difference being that here I also allow the process to give no output at all. But otherwise, it's possibilistic in the sense that we identify all non-zero probabilities and just talk about possible events and impossible event, possible outcomes and impossible outcomes. Okay? Well, now it's not so difficult to check that with all these definitions, I'm going to get a category of processes. So in each of these cases, there's an obvious way to compose those processes, and there's also an obvious trivial process which does nothing. Okay, I'm not going to go in any more details because this should be, well, sufficiently clear. okay. All right, now we're going to get to the first kind of, let's say, piece of meat of category theory. So far, this was just language. So I would like to get to something that I've been calling them conditional processes. And I'm going to make a particular assumption on the category, which is satisfied in all these examples, all these toy examples I mentioned. So the assumption being that for every two system types, X and Y, there is a system type X plus Y. So this is just some abstract notation. This doesn't need to have anything to do with addition. And processes, one process from X to X plus Y, I'm going to call this process kappa 1. And another process from Y to X plus Y. Having a certain property and this property is an instance of something which occurs very frequently in category theory. It's called a universal property. Okay, maybe I should mention now that this, how to think of X plus Y. So this is supposed to represent a system type which can either be a system of type X or a system of type Y. And this kind of comprises, supposed to comprise the two. And I hope that this will become a bit clearer. When I now formulate that property, so this universal property is saying that for all processes which go from X to a third system Z, well, it may coincide with one of the two, it may coincide with X plus Y, it doesn't matter. So it just should apply to all processes F having domain X. and processes G having domain Y and having the same codomain as the other one, that these two can be combined that there exists a unique process from x plus y to this third system z, and I'm going to call this process f bar g, which behaves like, so this is supposed to behave like f if this incoming system here actually, well, kind of intuitively speaking, happens to be of type x, and it's supposed to behave like g if this happens to be of type y. So this represents a kind of conditional process, which, depending on the input, behaves like one of the previous two. So it should behave like f after kappa 1. This is now a bit more precise than what I said, in the sense that if I start from x, apply kappa 1, and then this composed process, then this composition should precisely be this f. If I start on y and apply this kappa 2, and then the composed process, I'm supposed to recover this g. And this is supposed to work for all f and g having the same codomain and x and y as domains. So after k1, and it should behave like g after having applied kappa 2. Diagrammatically speaking, or we can kind of draw a little diagram which summarizes this, that there's this combined process here in the middle, and when I start from x, I apply kappa 1. So now I compose these two. This composition I'm drawing here, and this is supposed to be f. This is the condition, right? And similar for y. There's this kappa 2 process there, and I'm composing these two, and the condition is that this gives me g. So this is kind of a commutative diagram, but kind of the stuff which constantly appears in category theory. And now this is a category theoretical definition. Okay, now, well, now I should actually write below, but now I have some space left here, so let me put this here. So this I just basically mentioned. So the intuition behind this is that this combined process F bar G operates conditionally. So that if the incoming system is of type X, it just applies F. And if the incoming system is of type Y, it applies G. All right, so now why am I explaining this? Because this will let us define measurements. Yeah? Oh, OK, sorry. I thought I had to, but then I missed it. Yeah.
And this probably is going to hold. Now suppose we say that we know it has hold for x and x.
Right. Yes.
And processes kappa 1, kappa 2 is that extended the sort of kappa 1, kappa 2. If kappa 1, kappa 2 were different, then you would have kind of inconsistency. This is something.
Why?
If you
Yes. Yeah, we can have, I mean, we can have this system x plus x here, and we're just going to see in a minute in the examples that this indeed happens, and this is the case, that these two processes are then, so then we're going to have a kappa 1 here and a kappa 2, and these are going to be different. Yes, yeah. It holds in all these examples. So even when the two systems are the same. So the system types are the same. Oh, I see. Okay. That's a good point. Yeah, thanks. So one should kind of think of, yeah. So these two axes are kind of distinguished by the ordering here. I mean, these are not really the same x anyway. That if I apply kappa 1, I get a different x than if I apply kappa 2. So one has to be a bit careful with this intuition. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, no, not at all. Okay, sorry about this confusing notation. Well, so that paper, for example, actually uses a commutator notation, and I thought, no way I'm going to use a commutator notation. So I tried to think of something else, but now I see that this also is not optimal. Yeah. Well, if I would just take plus, then this is the standard notation used for denoting. There's also then going to be a process which takes x plus y to z plus z. And this is not what I want. Well, this sounds like a fraction, but I thought about that. And then, okay, no, wait, the slash is a fraction. It's like a quotient. Yeah. Okay, now I'm really getting to the basic definition of the paper. So far, this was all kind of prelude. Namely, getting to measurements. So I'm using a physics terminology here, but one can as well. And this was the basic idea. This is actually about logic. About logic in the category of those processes. And well, so the basic idea is that. Any measure, so what is a measurement? Well, a measurement on a physical system is just a certain kind of process, right? So any measurement is itself a process. Now let me give the definition of measurement. And I'm just going to consider a special case, namely a measurement only having two outcomes, a measurement which is binary. So this is because this is actually about logic, or this is intended actually to be about logic. And in logic, we want to talk about predicates, which are things which assign truth values to variables or truth values to elements of sets. Or so this is about binary things. So I'm talking about binary measurements here, and also ideal measurements. An ideal measurement is a measurement which does not disturb the system, right? So this is what I mean by ideal. And So in this language of processes, such a measurement I can define to be a process from x to x plus x. And so, okay. But not just any such process, but satisfying the additional assumption that if I apply that process and then go back to X by applying this trivial identity process of X, bar trivial identity process of X, this is supposed to give also the identity process, this trivial process for X. So one should think of this in physical terms, or let's say a physical real world example. It would be, let's say X represents the system type photon, then the measurement is given by a prism. So I don't, so this is something which has, and then the photon comes in here. I forgot how those things actually look like, but then, so it gets, there's some refraction going on, right? So then something like this. And depending on the color of that photon, so we think of this prism as measuring the color of the photon. Let's say we should only allow two colors for the photon, it will come out in two different directions. So what comes out here, this is kind of like a system of type photon plus photon, because it can represent either a photon kind of on this angle or a photon on that angle. So, and also in this sense, I guess one can see that the two, in this case, these two axes are here really are distinguished in a way, right? Because in this case, we have these two different angles, even if both are just photons. Okay, now this condition is saying that if I apply this measurement, so if I apply this P, if I apply this prism, and then I apply this conditional process. So remember that this bar or this combination represented like a conditional process which applies F in the first case and G in the other case. And this is saying in either case, I just do nothing. And I get I get again a system of type X back. So this condition is saying that in the case of the photons, I'm just doing nothing in either case to these photons, and I'm supposed to get the original system back. So this encodes the requirement that a measurement is supposed to be ideal, that it's supposed to not disturb the system. So this is a very abstract way of defining binary and non-disturbing measurements in any category of processes. And this is the point, that this is very universally applicable. Something, no. Yeah, I'm not perfectly sure about that either. But it's, I think it's something like that, yeah. We'll see the examples in a minute. Yeah, I'll show the examples now. And there we'll see that that this composition is the identity, or can be the identity. Yeah. Right. So what is the issue here? That this is not monochromatic, or? Yes. Exactly. Right. Well, yes. We're going to get to that. I mean, this was just supposed to be an intuition. But I'm going to get to that issue. Yeah, sure. Oh, I see. Yes, now I see your point. Yeah, sure. We're going to get there. Okay, so this intuition I'm not going to write down now anymore. But now let's go to the examples, because I'm running short. So I just would like to go through the same list of examples again. Where do I have them? Just these four examples. In the category of classical systems, we can identify. So what is this x plus x in, when we take the category to be just sets of states with arbitrary functions as processes? Then it turns out that this x plus x, it's just a set corresponding to x itself times or a Cartesian product with a two-element set. And this two-element set I'm going to write as having the two elements true and false. And so what kappa 1 and kappa 2 in this case are, so they should be functions from x to this set, and kappa 1 just maps, takes an element or a state little x and maps it to the pair x comma true, which is an element of that Cartesian product, and kappa 2 just takes x and maps it to x comma false. So when we now take this condition and kind of spell it all out, we're going to see that a measurement is a map from x to this product. No, true and false, having the property that P of x, or well, maybe I should say that this is, so this P of x is going to have two components then, right? It's going to have a component in x. And if we spell this property out, We're just going to find that this first component has to be x itself. And the second component is just some truth value t depending on x. So this is just saying that applying the measurement doesn't disturb the state and gives us the truth value, either true or false, which depends on that state. No. So I've just taken this Cartesian product. Or what do you mean? At what point did I apply any partitioning?
The measurement just picks out.
Okay. Oh yeah. So from this, in this perspective, this x plus x is just kind of the disjoint union of two copies of x. And if I have a state little x, which evaluates to true, this p is going to map it to the first copy. And if it's false, it's going to map it to the second copy. So this is kind of in this disjoint union picture what's going to happen. But anyway, so in this way, we can see that the measurement is actually defined by this function t, which is a function from x to true and false. So in this sense, a measurement, more specifically, this kind of binary ideal measurement corresponds to an assignment of truth values. So this is how and this is why this is actually about logic. Okay, now in the probabilistic case, this works quite similarly. And we're going to find that the same identification still holds. And blah, blah, blah. So this is essentially exactly the same up to the point where we get this t. So this t from true to false. No, actually, so this again turns out to be a process in that category. But the processes in that category are probabilistic maps, meaning that this conditional distributions, right? So that means that for every state little x in here, we're getting a probability distribution over true and false. And well, this is just a probability distribution over two outcomes. So it's determined by the probability of true. So in this way, we can identify a measurement in this probabilistic setting with an actual function or a map. From x to the interval 0, 1, assigning to every set x the probability, to every state little x, the probability of being evaluated, of the probability of evaluating to true. All right. Now, in the quantum case, so we have those C-star algebras. And OK, let's just look at this particular example where we actually have the n by n matrices, meaning that this is supposed to be a quantum system having an n-dimensional Hilbert space. So in this case, what we're dealing with, or spelling all this stuff out, is that we're getting a UCP map. So a completely positive and unital map from this direct sum of matrix algebras. So we should think of this as kind of actually 2n by 2n matrices with n by n blocks to this thing itself. So this represents kind of this A plus A, and this is A, but again, since we're in the Heisenberg picture and we kind of need to take the UCP maps, go the other way, the opposite way than the processes. So this doesn't go as a process, this goes from A to A plus A, but as a UCP map, this goes from A direct sum A to A. And well, this is this non-disturbance property, the probability of being an ideal measurement. And so I haven't really been able to prove this yet in complete detail, but as Raphael already said, these should not exist as soon as n is at least 2, of course. In the sense that there are just no ideal quantum measurements, there are just no measurements which don't disturb the system in the quantum case. So maybe one can interpret this again as a statement saying something like, well, quantum logic just doesn't work. yes. Oh, okay, yeah, here, maybe in the quantum case, I should mention that in the original paper, it's actually done differently. And in the paper, it's not done in terms of C-square algebras, but in terms of Hilbert spaces and maps between those, and then one needs this kind of funny dagger structures. But so what's done in the paper, I don't find very natural because one deviates from the same formalism. We need to distinguish, make kind of different definitions. And so if one does that, it works and one gets one does get some non-trivial measurements. But if one tries to apply the same formalism as I've done it here, it seems that one doesn't get any measurements. All right, so just to finish the last example, non-deterministic dynamics. In this case, again, we can apply the same identification. And we're again going to end up with a process going from x to the set of truth values. But now, in this case, this is a process in the category, again, meaning that this is actually as a map or as a function going from x to the power set. So as a function, this actually goes to the power set of true and false. And again, if one spells out that condition and then all that, one finds the additional condition. So let me call this f maybe. One finds the additional condition that f of x should not be the empty set. So then we just have three possibilities remaining in here, right? Namely, just either only true or only false or both. So this means that f of x has to be an element of the set just true, false, or both, and well, I guess the interpretation of these two is clear. But now, what if f of x has that funny value? Yeah. What if f of x has that funny value? What does that mean? So this just represents an undetermined. So this is the undetermined truth value. Well, yeah. Can interpret this if you want. So epistemologically, saying that, well, I just don't know if it's true or false. That's why I'm assigning it both at the same time, so to speak. So in this way, using this kind of definitions, we can start from any category of processes, applying this machinery, we get out a definition of measurement, or a definition of, well, in the paper it's actually called predicate. So to every category we can associate a certain kind of logic in this way. And this has actually lots of additional structure, which I'm not going to talk about here. So this is just a very basic definition and very basic idea, but then there's a lot more one can do with this. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks.
In the quantum case, there's a tight connection between the direct sum structure and the tensor product. If I have a direct sum in Hilbert space in itself, I can equally well represent that in Hilbert space, tensor product, two-dimensional Hilbert space.
Yes. Well,
Similarly,
what
with the
corresponds
classical
to this
case.
isomorphism, this
Right.
isomorphism, yeah.
So I'm just curious, in a lot of these categorical representations of physical processes, axioms are made about the tensor product structure, and nothing is said about any kind of direct sum structure. So is there a connection between, like, what do the assumptions that you've made about this direct sum structure imply about the tensor product structure?
Yeah, I don't know, not very much, I'm afraid. Also, so if we use this definition, the tensor product actually doesn't arise from such a definition. So from this x plus y definition. What we get is from this definition is a direct sum. We can apply also kind of dual definition, then we get on the Sister algebra level, we get free products. But so I don't really know of any way to get the tensor product in that way. So this one seems that one has to additionally impose that kind of as additional structure in the category, which is not determined by the rest. I don't know if that answers that.
See how the quantum case, the one place where this doesn't really work. I mean, you're saying there aren't any measurements of this sort. I can see how
Sorry?
it won't. I remember now you're saying that in the quantum case, these sorts of ideal measurements don't exist.
Yeah.
So I see how it won't be clearly related to the tensor product that we usually use in
Okay,
the case.
yeah.
On that same question, so your conclusion is that there is no ideal measurement in the quantum, non-trivial in the quantum case. But
If one uses this formalism, then I think no. So I haven't proved it in all detail, but this.
you think there's a theorem that says that
Yes.
it cannot
Yeah.
use it. But the paper you quoted had proposed something different for what a quantum
Yes.
measurement
Yes.
was.
Yes. So maybe you know these Dagger categories in terms of this Kekulé style things,
Yeah, we've got
where you also didn't talk about positivity and whatnot. So if one takes this Dagger, if one uses that approach, which is different because in there the morphisms don't represent processes. If one uses that approach and kind of adjusts all these definitions, such as to take this Dagger structure into account, one can get a reasonable definition of measurement also in the quantum case. And or only in the quantum case, because then it doesn't apply anymore to all the rest. But what one gets then are the positive operators on Hilbert space, which are below the identity.
But your criticism is that basically they set up a general structure and they've given
yes.
a sort of nice definition of what a measurement should be.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and
yeah,
they
yeah.
threw it away when they came to quantum mechanics.
Right. Well, it's a bit exaggerated, but yes, something
yes,
like
right.
that. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And if you keep it, then you get the conclusion.
Yes.
That quantum mechanics
yeah,
is
yeah,
not
yeah,
a
yeah, yes.
ideal
because,
measurement.
So thinking of this physically, they don't actually say that this corresponds, well, Jacob doesn't actually say that this corresponds to an ideal measurement. In the sense of a non-disturbing measurement, but that's what it is. And even already intuitively, this cannot work in the quantum case, right?
Then I had one a different. So you said this is supposed to be the beginning of logic. So do they go on and find a whole bunch of rules of inference for this new logic? Or which of the classical rules of inference survive in this logic? Like modus ponens or whatever these classes.
Yes, so rules of inference are not in that paper. So I don't know if one can do that. But so the stuff that is in the paper and that one can do are certain operations on these predicates or measurements. Like one can define something which corresponds to and. It also has some, if you know the term, an effect algebra structure. That's kind of the main, actually the, one of the themes of the paper, that these measurements in any category, in most categories of processes, then get a structure of an effect algebra, which is a certain kind of set of operations one can do with them, corresponding to a bit of logic, and stuff like substituting variables. And so this sort of stuff one can do, but I don't know about rules of inference.
I wonder if there's another way of interpreting structure that you have, not in terms of measurements where the system is left over afterwards, but just in terms of the what you've learned about the initial state of the system given the outcome. So
uh-huh.
an extreme example, imagine that the system is totally destroyed by the measurement,
yeah.
the photons absorbed,
yeah.
but you've learned something. So you could think of the original X as you know, representing your initial knowledge of the system, and then the final X that you map to is like,
uh-huh.
what do you believe about the system after
uh-huh.
this is all said and done?
Uh-huh.
So the first map could be sort of the learning map, and the second map could be the forgetting map. So suppose you forget the outcome of your measurement, then you expect to get back to whatever
knowledge
you had
originally.
So I mean like your x to x plus x, and then back from x plus x to x.
Okay.
I can't remember what name to give for those guys.
So here we have two. We have this kappa 1 and we have this kappa 2.
Yeah.
So it's actually that. So kappa 1 kind of represents true, and kappa 2 kind of represents false.
Okay.
Or measurements represent measurements which have deterministic outcomes.
And then you have the map back to x.
Right. So this kind of forgets the measurement outcome, yeah.
Right. So I think everything you said about the classical case would go through just fine, because if I forget the outcome of the measurement, then what I know
mm-hmm.
about the system hasn't changed.
Right.
But now there's
yes.
an opportunity maybe to
yes.
define
okay.
these kinds
agree.
Of things
yeah.
in quantum mechanics, because
uh-huh.
you could say if all I'm doing is describing the initial state,
mm-hmm.
not the state after the measurement, then if I tell you, okay, you know, what do you know about the initial state after seeing the measurement outcome, what do you know about the initial state not seeing the measurement outcome?
Mm.
What you know about the state not seeing the measurement outcome is exactly what you knew initially, so it should be identity.
Well, then we would have to relax some of these conditions, no? Because, I mean, so this should be a mathematical effect independent of the interpretation. So
I guess my if my interpretation fits your definitions, then I'm skeptical of the claim that these things should not exist. Alternatively, something about my story might
yeah.
violate one of your constraints.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I don't see what in the mathematics makes me have to interpret this as a kind of physical process and your final object.
Okay, no, nothing really. It's not the only interpretation possible, I suppose. But I find it's just a natural interpretation to explain it.
The other small thing I would note is that if you talk about algebras that have like super selection sectors, so the quantum within the sectors
yeah.
and classical between, then you'd have an example where you could have non-trivial measurements
Right, certainly, yes, sense. I know. So this is why I was restricting to this kind of example.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thanks.